Plato to own the libs, and you were referencing the culture war, and you've written a piece to encourage people to put culture back in the culture war, that the problem with the culture wars is that there's not much culture in it. And in a piece that you wrote for Symposium, you compared this to the late 1980s, in which, in the wake of Alan Bloom's blockbuster, The Closing of the American Mind, there was the situation through what your case for putting culture back in the culture wars is, and how you diagnose the problem.
Okay, thanks for the intro. Yeah, so I wrote this piece about putting the culture back in the culture wars, and if I don't know how many people still remember Alan Bloom, but he made a big stir in 1987 with this book, The Closing of the American Mind, which really kind of warned us and predicted everything that would happen. Well, everything would happen in the 90s with what we call political correctness, and the return of political correctness today, which is called wokeness, for lack of a better word. And it really says, he said, it came from this philosophy that encouraged people to, that everything was subjective, everything was relative, it all depended on who you were and what your perspective was. So, you know, as a person of color, you had one perspective, or as a left-handed lesbian tugboat worker or whatever, you know, you chop these people into the narrower and narrower categories. And there was no universal truth, and there was no grounding in a deeper appreciation of the big ideas of Western civilization. Now, he was at the University of Chicago about the time that I showed up there, and this is the home of the great books approach to education. And what it struck me is that there was a culture war back in the late 80s that was really about, should we be studying the big ideas, the great ideas of Western civilization? Should we be reading Plato? Now, I mentioned Plato partly because I've got a couple reasons why I'm mentioning Plato. One of them is that Alan Bloom was most famous as a Plato scholar. He did a widely used translation of Plato's Republic, also widely criticized translation. So it's the idea that, you know, we should read Plato to own the libs. That was the culture war of the time. That a grounding in these big ideas was the answer to the subjectivism and the tribalism of what we then called political correctness. And I think that's the thing that's been lost from this current go-around of the culture war, is that it's become tribalism from all sides. It's that the conservatives, I think, fought and lost that original culture war, the Alan Bloom era and late 1980s culture war, and they've kind of given up on the big ideas. And that's what we really need to go back to. And that's why I say read Plato to own the libs. But there's a couple of reasons why I specifically say Plato, and I want to go into that a little bit. Now, the reason we read Plato is really not necessarily because of Plato, it's because of Socrates. So Plato, he's a great philosopher from around 400 BC, great Greek philosopher, and he presented his philosophy in a series of what were called dialogues at the time. And this is, you know, a dialogue is basically just a fictional conversation. So, Plato, and in the process of that conversation, Plato would walk you through his philosophical arguments that for the point that he was trying to make. And the person he always has taking his, sort of speaking on his behalf, is his teacher, Socrates, who's a real guy. We know Socrates mostly through Plato's dialogues. So you have a few other places that he's written about other students of his. But we know Socrates mostly through Plato. And Socrates was the guy, this is middle of the 400s BC in Greece, who really defined the basic questions of philosophy and the basic method of philosophy as distinct from what had come before. The basic things that Socrates originated, that he stood for, was first of all the idea of questioning received opinion. So just about every dialogue begins with him asking a question like, what is justice or what is truth? And people come up with, well, they come up with the standard answers that an average person of, you know, 5th century BC Greece would come up with. And then Socrates also says, well, let's take a look at that answer and pokes holes in it and asks other questions and shows that it's not quite adequate and we need to ask more questions and come up with new answers and come up with better answers. So it's the idea of taking the sort of received opinion, the things that everybody thinks they know, and subjecting them to scrutiny and criticism. The second thing about Socrates, is that he's willing to do so even when it's unpopular, even when it makes people mad. And of course, that famously got Socrates in trouble because he was eventually put to death. He was executed for so-called corrupting the youth of Athens by making them ask all these uncomfortable questions. And then the other thing is that the big difference, the reason why Socrates is considered the guy who started the whole field of philosophy, is he was different from the sophists. The sophists were sort of wise men or teachers who were going around Greece at the time, very commonly found around Greece at the time, who used some of the same sort of philosophical arguments, but they were all about rhetoric. They were weren't about seeking the truth. They were about teaching how to win an argument. And the rap against the sophists is they were good at teaching you how to make the worst argument look like it's the better one, right? And what Socrates taught was the idea that, no, this isn't about arguing. This isn't about putting people down. It isn't about owning the libs. This is about seeking the truth. And you can see how all of that's so very relevant to today. The idea of questioning the received opinions or the majority opinions, doing so even when it makes people angry and when it's unpopular, and doing it not just in order to win the argument or to own the libs, but in order to seek out the truth. Now, there's one last reason why I'm bringing up Plato in particular. Now, Socrates is my main guy of interest. But Plato in particular is because he wrote his philosophy in the form of dialogues. And that was the predominant way of presenting philosophy, of engaging philosophy at the time, is you would have a conversation. And I think that's the other big thing that's relevant to today, is this idea that you gain the truth by engaging in conversation and bringing different viewpoints and disagreements and answering them and going back and forth between those different viewpoints. Recently, Jonathan Rauch wrote a very good book called The Constitution of Knowledge, where he talks about the relevance of this to today, and particularly against wokeness or political correctness. And he starts the book by referring to Plato's dialogue Theaetetus. Now, most of the dialogues are named after the person Socrates is having a conversation with. So the beginning of the book is that Socrates is walking down the street in Athens. He meets this guy named Theaetetus, and they have a whole long conversation about the nature of truth. And what Jonathan Rauch pointed out is that the most important thing in the dialogue is at the very end, where Socrates says to Theaetetus, "Let us meet and talk of this again." And that's the most important thing about it, is that truth was found by people engaging in the conversations, by meeting and talking and having different viewpoints and hashing them out. And all of that, I think, is so crucially, vitally important to today's sort of culture war environment that we're in, and an answer really to both sides of the culture war, that we need to be questioning the received opinions. We need to be doing it when it's unpopular. We need to be doing it not just to win the argument, but to seek the truth. And let us meet and talk of this again. We need to be doing this constantly in dialogue among people with differing opinions. So that's sort of my case for reading Plato to own the libs, or really reading Plato as an answer to today's culture wars.
Thank you, Rob. And I wanted to mention, thanks to Scott's suggestion, we are trying to record this session, so keep that in mind and bear with us. We want to try to make it available to more people. I'd also like to acknowledge that we have one of our senior scholars, Professor Stephen Hicks, here, or not, and we had a great session with him last week, and just a shame that we weren't able to record that. And then also we have a horn blaring outside. So I'm going to, there we go. We have the chairman of the Atlas Society's Board of Trustees, Jay LaPere, and also Dale Bottoms, who's a dear friend and a supporter. So I also see the room filling in. So I want to encourage any of you to just go ahead, raise your hand. I might just call on you. There we go, Brian.
Hey, yeah.
Welcome.
Hey, thanks. I was introduced to Ayn Rand kind of in middle age, but to me, it was just her work spoke to me as a way I had lived my entire life, and so it was just incredible. So my question is, it's maybe slightly off topic, but to me it pertains, and I can connect the dots if you want, but. When I think about Ayn Rand's philosophy about the nature of reality being the basis of our morals, our reason, our connecting the dots of how we should live, I seem to see where people conflate truth with knowledge, and they use those words interchangeably, and I'll be very direct about it. The way I see it is, truth pertains to the physical world. So if you look at the way Ayn Rand talked about it, she's saying that, you know, following on from Aristotle's axiom, existence exists, that's the nature of truth. But when we talk about knowledge, we sometimes conflate the two. And so I would just say to Rob or whoever wants to jump in, tell me where I'm missing the point here, or maybe where I'm getting this wrong. Absolute truth exists in terms of reality. The laws of nature, etc., exist, and that is truth, but absolute knowledge does not. So there's no way for us to have absolute knowledge over anything, because certain aspects of physical reality, dark matter, dark energy, quantum mechanics, you know, the list goes on. There's just too much that we don't know. And not only that, no one person can know everything about anything. So help me understand where I'm going wrong. Absolute truth exists. Absolute knowledge does not. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Yes. We have certain limitations of what we can know, including no mind reader technology app yet. So dialogue remains important. Go ahead, Rob.
All right. So I'm going to take that from the beginning. I think the semantic difference between truth and knowledge is a little iffy in terms of how the words are used. You know, I think truth is something that's real that is known to us, right? It's a truth, I think, implies a knower of the truth, right? So reality is a term for just simply anything that exists, whether we know it or not. So I would say the difference you're making between truth and knowledge, I'm not, just as a semantic, in terms of how the words are used, I'm not sure. I think there's a big difference between those two. But I do think there's a difference between what we call philosophically the metaphysical and the epistemological, right? So the metaphysical is pertaining to that which exists, and things that exist whether we know them or not, whether there's anybody to observe them or not, they still exist, they persist in their existence, and they are what they are. So that, you know, that's the metaphysical aspect of it. And then the epistemological aspect involves the idea of somebody knowing it. You know, epistemology is the science of how we know things. So there is a difference between, you know, that which exists is obviously it's an unlimited quantity of things that are out there that exist that we don't know because we can only perceive so much at any one time. What I don't like is the idea that no absolute knowledge exists. Like, I can look out my window right now and say this. Well, I was going to say the sky is blue. It's sort of a grayish blue. Okay, it's still blue. I could go look out my window right now and say the sky is blue. Or I could say in your little icon here with the atlas from Rockefeller Center, the sky is blue in that photo, and that's an absolute not fact. It's a directly observable fact. There's no uncertainty in it, right? So we have absolute knowledge of the things that are available to us, that are available for direct perception or for sound, solid reasoning for that direct perception. But what we're really looking for here is the idea that we are the amount we can know and the amount that we can know with certainty is finite. So we're not omniscient. You know, there's a limit to how much we can observe and how much we can know and the number of valid inferences we can make from that. Now, the limit keeps getting bigger and bigger as humankind as a species gets to know more and more. For an individual, it's still limited. You have to, rely, when I go to the doctor, I rely on his specialty knowledge. I'm not acting on my firsthand knowledge. I'm acting on my judgment of whether this guy, this physician I'm going to, seems to know what he's talking about. So there are always limits, and there are decisions you have to make in the face of uncertainty given those limits. But I don't like the idea that there's no such thing as absolute knowledge. There is absolute knowledge of the things that you can directly know or make clear inferences about. It's just that the knowledge that's absolute to you is limited in quantity and in scope.
Okay, so I would say that if you're saying as a sentence, the sky is blue, there is a semantic range of ambiguity in each of those nouns or adjectives. So blue is a range. And, you remember that controversy, I don't know, a couple years ago about the dress, whether it was gold or, right?
Or white and gold. I actually wrote about that because that was fascinating. Go ahead.
It was fascinating, and it boils down to the individual differences in terms of the perceptual capabilities of each individual observer. So in that regard, I would say there's no sentence that you can speak just because of the limitation of words. There's no sentence that you can speak that is objectively true. I mean, not even 1 + 1 = 2, because I could say, one man plus one woman equals one marriage. Or I could say one idea plus one idea, if we share aspects of that same, foundational creative endeavor, one idea plus one idea equals one business, or something along those lines. So there's ambiguity in every sentence that you could possibly utter.
Yeah, Brian, thank you. I do want to make sure that we are able to circle back to the main theme, which is about culture and dialogue. But I also wanted to acknowledge that we have Professor David Kelly, founder of the Atlas Society, who is an expert in the topic of epistemology, and perhaps get his view on the proposition that Brian has put forward, that absolute truth exists, but absolute knowledge cannot, and Rob suggesting that he's would not agree with absolute knowledge not existing, and that it can exist, but not infinitely, but with regards to particular circumstances.
Actually, can I just say that before David comes in, I just wanted to make a quick thing to Brian. I wrote a piece, we're talking about the blue and gold, blue and black dress versus white and gold dress. I wrote a piece about that a couple years ago called Laurel and Yanni and Manny and Ayn. Manny being Immanuel Kant and Ayn Rand being Ayn Rand. That was the Laurel versus Yanni was a sort of an auditory version of the same thing. So if you just Google that, Laurel and Yanni and Trzynski, and you'll find that piece. So that might find that interesting in addressing that particular case.
Thank you.
David. Hi.
Hi, Jack. I'm sorry. I joined late. I just got back from a dentist appointment longer than I expected. No Novocaine, though, so I'm not going to mumble unless I do so naturally. I haven't heard the whole context. I just heard Brian's point. But on that point, I mean, look, every proposition that you could put in words involves concepts. And concepts are formed by a process of abstraction involving similarity with things that you may have perceived in the past but are no longer perceiving. So there's always that, it's not direct in the way that actually looking at the sky is direct awareness, or looking at anything or hearing anything is direct awareness. But the we have to understand the issue of certainty arises only for conceptual knowledge, and it has to be understood contextually as what's relevant to what's the way in which the conceptual faculty functions. So when Rob says the sky is blue, there's a context of the sky. It's an indefinite point of reference, to be sure, but we all understand what he's talking about. And blue covers a range of colors, yes, but saying it's blue is within, you know, whatever shade of blue it is blue. So I don't see any uncertainty there. And the examples of mathematics is interesting, because mathematics is often held up as an a priori discipline that's not compatible with objectivism. But the 1+1 example, there's a context. When I say 1+1, it means 1 unit plus 1 unit is equal in number to 2 units. It's a simple quantitative statement. It has a context. So one man and one woman, yeah, may make a marriage, but there's still one man and one woman, 2 people involved in that marriage, and so on. So I'm not getting it. Honestly, I think a lot of the skeptical arguments against certainty drop the context of how human knowledge is acquired and how it works. So I'll just leave it there and let Rob get back to his discourse.
Thank you.
Thanks. If I can pitch into that, just one last thing I want to point. If we're talking about the ancient Greeks, Brian's sort of the school of Diogenes, the Cynic, one of the yes. schools of skepticism, of radical skepticism. I mean, if you think the sky is blue, it's not absolute. That's radical skepticism. But specifically, we talked about Plato, or we talked about Socrates, we talked about Plato. Well, Plato was Socrates' student, and Aristotle was Plato's student. And Aristotle had the answer to this thing about ambiguity, though, because he was the one who said, you have to say at the same time and in the same respect. You know, a thing cannot both be and not be at the same time and in the same respect. So his idea is, where there are ambiguities, you engage in further inquiry to clear up the ambiguity. So if I say the sky is blue and you say, well, what do you mean by the sky? I can then specify what I mean by the sky. I think, you know, it's not necessary in such a commonplace phrase. And some of that parsing, it can get very Clinton-esque, you know. It depends on what the meaning of the word is, and can be done in bad faith. Anyway, I think that's I look to Aristotle for the answer on that in his formulation of the issues.
Thank you. And the reason I connect these dots is because I get into arguments about objectivism and realism and capitalism and communism and all these, you know, big issues. And to me, it kind of boils down to this notion of what is truth, what is knowledge, because you have different people who cherry pick certain economic or social data, and then they use that and they either willfully or ignorantly ignore other pieces of data. And so I see these limitations in terms of knowledge. And even if someone is thoroughly fluent on a given topic, they kind of misconstrue truth and conflate truth and knowledge. And so that's where my connection to the topic enters the discussion, if you will.
Well, do you know how it is that we know that communism works? Because every time it doesn't work, that wasn't real communism.
Right. Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate the discussion.
Ferris, welcome. Did you have a question or a comment? I'm going to also invite Scott up to the stage.
Yeah, I just have a question, which I hope you guys don't take as if I had malicious intent. I'm just genuinely curious. I mean, just from the title of the room, Read Plato to Own the Libs, I just want to know, like, what is the relation between reading Plato and owning the libs?
Well, okay, so this is sort of a provocative title, but it actually came from something I wrote in my article where I was saying that, you know, in the previous iteration of the culture war in the late 80s, this is the article you may have missed the very beginning. There's an article I wrote a while back. I think Jennifer may have a link that she's posted on it about basically putting the culture back in the culture wars. And in this previous iteration of it, I talked about, you know, these guys like Alan Bloom and the University of Chicago guys who were arguing in favor of the importance of the great books. And as I put it, they wanted you to read Plato to own the libs. And it was sort of a joking reference because they really didn't want you to read Plato to own the libs. That, not that that term was used at the time, but, you know, it could become popular later. But rather they wanted you to read Plato in order, and the other great books, in order to gain a greater understanding of the truth, in order to engage with these big ideas. And so it's my way of saying this is the real answer to our current culture war, right? Because what we have now is that you have a bunch of the conservatives in the culture war whose main goal seems to be to, quote unquote, own the libs, which is, you know, engaging in sort of meme warfare and dealing with it on a lot of gotcha sort of stuff of, oh, look at the latest outrage of the day on social media. Somebody claimed this and somebody claimed that and how terrible it is. And not really engaging with the big ideas and that are the actual answer, I think, to how we get out of the fruitless conflicts that we're in the current culture war. So that's what reading Plato to own the libs means is engage with big ideas and important philosophical discussions about the truth in order to get ourselves out of the current sort of fruitless back and forth between these two different sides of the culture war.
Thank you. And Ferris, I sent you the link to the article just now that Rob is talking about. I think it was a kind of a provocative title, but also a bit of an ironic title, because it's a title that says, oh, read this to beat the other guy. But what he's talking about is that this cultural debate has devolved into something very tribal and partisan, and it's all about beating the other team and less about what the substance is of what you have to say. So I suppose we could do another one that would be similarly, you know, read Plato to own the right. So I think it's a little bit more about the dialectics of dialogue and what has...
My next clubhouse will be titled Plato Was Never Trump.
Well, we can debate about that, but we might come down on different sides, but we're looking into it. We're looking into it. All right, Scott, what have you got for us?
Thank you. I was just going to say about your original point that I read that sophists were people that you could get to take any position by paying them, which, I mean, maybe the same as just wanting to win or lose. But the other point I wanted to make was really a bit of a defense of owning the libs, just because I've seen lots of libertarians kind of join the left and kind of mocking that. And I just, it triggers me, to be honest. It seems like, you know, they're saying don't defend yourself. And I do think there's value in counterpunching, both as a type of self-defense and a type of moral judgment. That's what I wanted to say.
No, I think there's a good point there, because, you know, my point of this isn't now there is actually what he's talking about. I've noticed there's a sort of, it's some libertarians, and there's been this trend. The Niskanen Center seems to be it's a DC think tank that used to be, you know, very hardcore libertarian and then sort of went center left. And it's a sort of a center for people who are doing this, who are sort of taking a libertarianish approach. Most of them came out of libertarianism, but they're sort of coming in from the cold and becoming center left. And they sort of poo-poo, I think Will Wilkinson was the guy who used to talk about cancel culture doesn't really exist. And then, of course, he got canceled, which I think was hilarious. he got fired from the Niskanen Center for saying something on Twitter that people got angry about. So he got he said cancel culture doesn't exist, and then he gets canceled. So there was this sort of cottage industry, and it's part of, I think, wanting to, there's this tendency in politics and in political debates, and it goes, and it's not just in partisan politics, but it spills over to the culture war stuff. This tendency to say, I have to choose sides, right? So if I criticize the left, then therefore I got to side with the right. And if I criticize the right, I have to side with the left. And there's no imperative to do that at all. In fact, you know, it's usually a bad idea. One of the people I like the best, that's why one of the people I like the best in the culture war is Kathy Young. Because she does these really detailed articles, you know, going over whatever the latest person who got canceled. There's one guy, a music professor at Michigan, who got in trouble because he showed a Laurence Olivier performing Othello as part of a class on adapting Verdi's opera Othello, and talk about various different adaptations of Othello. So he shows Laurence Olivier portraying Othello in blackface. I mean, people went ballistic, and there's all these arguments going back and forth. Kathy Young does a good job of saying, okay, let's consider all the arguments seriously and not feeling like you have to decide with one side or side with the other. A lot of times in the culture war, I find it sort of like what Kissinger said about the Iran-Iraq war. It's a pity they can't both lose. And I think that's sort of the plan that I have, which actually, but the outcome I'm looking for is that they should both lose. And so what I find a lot of times is that you have some people, like you said, that there's some people who try to make excuses. I call them, they're sort of anti-anti is the spirit of the age, right? So somebody came up with this once, I think Jonathan Last, who I worked with at the Bulwark, came up with the phrase anti-anti-Trump to describe some people I worked with at the Federalist, who for a little while there were like, whenever Trump did something, they would say, well, I'm not going to defend Trump, but I'm going to criticize the people who are criticizing Trump. So I'm not for Trump, but I'm anti-anti-Trump, which is totally different from being pro-Trump. And oftentimes it doesn't really, you know, so the people do anti-anti-cancel culture, right? Where they say, well, I'm not in favor of cancel culture, but I'm going to criticize the critics of it. But at the same time, I find you have some people on the right, and I find like Chris Rufo from the Manhattan Institute does this a lot, where
it's one of my heroes.
He's done great work in exposing a lot of this stuff, but then he uses it. And you have to look at some of the things he does. He uses this to basically say, therefore, we have to sign up for a conservative authoritarian agenda where we legislate what people can say and what they can't say, and we shut down Facebook, and basically saying we should use the power of the state to impose our own ideology. And otherwise, if we don't do that, we're not really fighting back. And he aims a lot of his anger at people like me and people like David French, who are the sort of classical liberals who don't want the government, you know, we don't want cancel culture, but we don't want the government imposing, telling people what they can and cannot say and trying to impose conservative values either. And, we've also realized the supreme foolishness of scheming to give the government more power only to have it, you know, because we know what's going to happen. You scheme to give the government more power over social media companies because you don't like that they're in the hands of the left. And who's going to end up wielding that power? Well, the left is going to end up wielding that power. We know this. We've had a lot of experience. So I think the thing is you need that, the idea of this sort of third alternative of somebody saying, you know, the cancel culture is bad, the authoritarian solutions offered on the right are bad, and offering the third alternative. And I think the third alternative that's really missing is read Plato on the lips.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I feel like the left uses a sense of inevitable victory to try to demoralize us. And within that, they, I don't want to always just be telling our people they're not fighting right instead of focusing on the main threat.
Well, the main threat, I think, is the mistake that people make, because I don't view
it's the ones
main
calling
threat.
Me and Ayn Rand a bigot, telling me I have no place in their future.
No, what I say is I think the main threat, because sometimes I get the same stuff. You should see what guys like Sohrab Ahmari are doing, right? These are guys who there is an authoritarian wing of the right that wants to use this cancel culture stuff as an excuse to say, therefore we should be basically imposing Christianity on everybody. So my view is the main threat is whoever's close to power, closer to power at the given moment. But the big thing is this, that the enemy of my enemy is not always my friend. And you have to be careful. You have to look at that. And so the main thing is, I'm not saying don't fight the cancel culture people. I'm talking about how you fight the cancel culture people. And the big thing is to, and that's why I said replay to own the libs, is that the way to fight them is that the previous conservative culture war was much better. The conservatives lost it because I think they gave up on it. But the previous version was, we should be getting people to engage with the big ideas and read the great books and do and engage on this on a more on a deeper, more intellectual level, and not just, you know, stoking outrage against the latest outrageous thing somebody said. It actually doesn't accomplish all that much. So I would say, you know, we have to remember what Breitbart said. And this is, you know, before Breitbart became what it became now. We're talking about the original guy, Andrew Breitbart, who said politics is downstream of culture. And I think the idea of focusing on what we can do to revive the culture, and this is really, it's a moral reform movement. It's not a political, the political stuff is very secondary to that. And the biggest thing to revive for the moral reform movement in the culture is to focus on the positive thing that we want people to focus on, which is actually engaging with the big ideas. You know, we had one of the other Atlas scholars who was here last week talking about how, you know, he has, his biggest problem is dealing with students who won't even read John Locke or won't even read some other philosopher because he's associated with something bad in their minds. And they're literally closing off their minds. That's the fundamental problem you have to deal with. And, you know, the political debate going on is very secondary to that.
I just want to add that, I mean, you keep talking about Plato, so I guess it's only fair to say that Plato, or Socrates or Plato, emphasize knowledge and how important knowledge is, and knowledge is kind of king. And so I guess that kind of plays in with engaging with these big ideas. And I'm interested to hear your take on, there's a line in one of Plato's books called Gorgias, where Socrates says that partnership and friendship hold together heaven and earth, gods and men. That's why they call the universe a world order. So, I mean, I'd be interested to hear your take on, you know, the fact that people, rather than working together, are working against each other. So, just, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what angle to take on. That's kind of a broad observation. But I do think that the reason why I think we...
David also might have a thought on Ferris's question.
Yeah, if you want to go, David, I've got some thoughts I'm forming here, but go ahead.
I'm not sure this addresses Ferris's question, but I did want to ask Rob. Yeah. I'm hearing two themes here from you. One is that the conservatives are just playing the dialectical game of attacking the liberals as the liberals or the left is attacking conservatives, and a better position, and they're all ignoring the classical liberals, and or worse, they're crashing us. But the other theme is, and that's a political theme, but the other theme is epistemological. We should be not focused on who's winning a certain battle of ideas, but what the truth is. And I assume that's why you cited Plato. And I'm kind of curious why Plato, not Aristotle. But am I right in identifying those two themes?
Yes, absolutely. And I want to go. So you came in a couple minutes late, David. So I did a little spiel about why Plato specifically.
Okay. And, all right. Well, don't repeat it. I'm sorry. I apologize for being late. So
yeah, but I do want to say that I do agree Aristotle is better than Plato in terms of the actual substance of his philosophy. But you know, it's Socrates really that I was aiming for with Plato, because he's the hero of all these things. And it's Socrates is the guy who starts the whole ball rolling about thinking about these big ideas and big questions. But you know,
okay, Aristotle, I'm with you on that.
Aristotle does a way better job of coming up with actual answers than Plato does.
Okay. And on the two issues, epistemological and political, is that accurate?
Yeah. And I think that that's the level that I think conservatives have stopped playing on, is the epistemological level of the idea that the real reform is how we think. Let me give an example of this. This is something that just came across my transom, came across my threshold in the last couple of days. Kathy Young mentioned a really good article about this case in University of Michigan. And in passing, she refers to this other case from Arizona that was just amazing when you look at the details. So apparently there is a Cornish pasty-themed restaurant in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, that surprises me, but why the heck not? The Cornish pasty is this little meat pie that they make in Cornwall in England. But apparently somebody from England settled in Phoenix and started this restaurant. And in this restaurant, they have these pictures of a wall of, you know, old-timey pictures of like coal miners from Cornwall, because Cornwall was a famous coal mining area. And they had a patron come in there who was black, and he looks at this picture of these coal miners and says, "These guys are in blackface. This is horrible. How can you have a photo of people in blackface up on the wall of your restaurant?" Now, if you know anything, even the slightest thing about coal mining, you know, you're laughing right now, because of course these guys aren't in blackface. They're covered with coal dust, which is what happens when you're in a coal mine, especially in the early 20th century. And these, you know, and it just shows how, you know, the left has, you started out as the sort of posing itself as the doctrine of the common man, of the worker, standing for the workers. And of course it's become the ideology of middle class white collar workers who have absolutely no idea what a coal miner looks like, right? So it's totally perfect that somebody would see a coal miner and not realize, oh, this is coal dust, right? So anyway, so this is a ridiculous, and then this became an op-ed in the Arizona Republic, and it became a whole controversy because this guy didn't know what coal miners looked like. So this is the kind of absurdity. But the thing that emerged from it that stood out to me was the guy defended making a big deal out of this photo, because he said, well, look, you know, maybe these coal miners weren't in blackface. They just had coal dust on their faces. But it still makes people feel a certain way to see that photo, and therefore the objection is valid. So it's this whole idea of my feelings are the most important thing. And if the facts come up and contradict my emotional reaction, it's my emotional reaction that stays and the facts that get subordinated to it. And that's why I say this is primarily, it's an intellectual reform and an epistemological reform that we need.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the ironies some of us have been pointing out is that, you know, it was a bunch of conservatives, like I think it was Ben Shapiro, who borrowed cribbed from Ayn Rand and said, facts don't care about your feelings. But somebody pointed out, you know, in some recent debates with conservatives, that the operative word there wasn't facts, it was your. Facts don't care about your feelings, they really care about mine. And I found that some conservatives have that problem too.
Yeah, that reminds me, I'm sure you're familiar with this, of the professor, I can't remember, this is a while back, who used the word niggardly in a lecture and got taken to reform camp at his campus.
Yeah, and it has a totally different etymological root, has nothing to do with the other, but yes.
So great. Thanks, Rob.
And Matt, who's new to Clubhouse, has raised his hand, and I have tried to call on you, Matt, but I will also send another invite. And if you can maybe just click on that, there you are. Yay.
Yeah, Rob. Oh, thanks. When you're speaking earlier about the truth, that one, I was hoping you'd make some more comments on that in this regard. I seem to hear a lot of religious people use truth in this weird artificial way. And so I was hoping you could comment on that. And as a side note to that, I'm sure you've probably seen the Prager video with, I can't think of his name, the objectivist.
Biddle?
Biddle, thank you, yes. Yeah, Craig Biddle. And he asked Prager about you know, evidence. And Prager said, oh, well, all this is evidence, but it's not proof. Well, and again, other than saying, well, you know, if what is proof, then overwhelming evidence, and how do you define that? But anyway, if you could just make comments on those, I'd like to hear it. Thank you.
Okay, so I have actually not seen that video, so I'm not going to know the specifics of it. I know Prager, I have a general sense of where Prager comes from. You know, the problem with arguing with someone like Prager is that, you know, he's someone who's so deeply committed to religion that you are not ever going to argue him out of it. And plus, there's also the aspect that it's very hard to convince somebody of something when their paycheck depends on not understanding it.
Sophist.
And, you know, what was that?
Sophist.
Yeah, the sophist. Yeah, there we go. And, you know, so Prager is somebody who is, he's engaged in Christian apologetics. And that's actually the term they use for it, which is basically, you know, you have a pre-existing faith commitment to Christianity. And apologetics consists of going out there and coming up and inventing arguments that will sort of help justify and defend Christianity. But the problem is that you're coming up with arguments that will justify and defend something for which you already have a existing pre-rational commitment to, right? So the sophist, Scott, that's a great observation. It is basically an updated version of, it's like sophistry, but for supposedly a better cause. Because really what it is I can take this thing that I want to be true, and I can invent as many arguments as, you know, as many arguments you come up with against it, I can invent arguments for it that will be seemingly convincing. And that, I think that's the problem with dealing with somebody like Prager. Now, there's perfectly valid to go and talk to and debate with somebody like that, but you're not debating to convince him. You're debating to reach, you know, as with most debates, you're debating to reach the audience, right? Not to reach your opponent, not to convince your opponent. But, you know, it does show that the problem with Christianity, and this is the problem with, this is why I'm saying that we have to have a third side in the culture war, because ultimately what the conservative side has to offer as their answer to the culture war is this woke stuff is terrible, it's irrational, it's awful, it's oppressive, it punishes people for these imagined infractions. And then the only real alternative is we have to go back and believe in God, for which we have no evidence and no proof. And so we impose our own dogma that we came up with from an irrational source. And so it's what undermines the conservative defense against cancel culture and wokeness or political correctness, whatever you want to call it. Note on the terminology. We kept political correctness was the term in the late 80s and 90s. Wokeness is the term now. It's really what's going on is it's the fundamental issue that has not changed is this epistemological idea that ultimately derives from, you know, Immanuel Kant as its most famous and most influential progenitor, of this idea that the truth depends on your perspective and it depends on your interests and your desires and who you are, that your perception of the world is so colored by your nature, which, you know, Kant said, oh, it's a collective delusion. It's our nature as human beings that colors our perceptions of the world, that determines how we perceive. But at least it's universal to everybody. And then what happened is subsequently, you know, people went to work on that assumption. Oh, you think all humans perceive the world the same way? Well, we're all different. And Marx says, well, we're all in different classes. Hegel said, we're all from different historical and national backgrounds and historical periods, and so we all perceive the world separately. And then Marx says, it's all classes, and then you get to race, class, and gender as our current version. But it's this radical subjectivism of everything's dependent on who I am, what my background is. You know, I'm a trans person of color, and therefore I have my ideas are valid because whatever I feel is valid because I feel it, because this is what's determined by my background as a trans person of color. And it's that epistemology of everything's determined by who I am and my nature and my background. It's all subjective to me. and therefore whatever I feel is true because I feel it. That's the enemy. And a guy like Prager, who poses as the opposite of all that, as the enemy of all that, ultimately it comes down to, well, I'm a Christian, and because I'm a Christian, I believe this. And I don't have proof. I don't have, you know, I think a player on word games about having evidence but not proof. But he's basically saying, I don't believe this on the basis of evidence. I don't believe this on the basis of arguments. I believe it based on this prior subjective commitment. And that's why I think that's problematic. I think it's also why it leads some of the more dedicated religious people, the sort of Sohrab Ahmari and to some extent Chris Rufo and these sort of nationalist conservatives, it's what leads them to say, therefore, fighting back means we need to seize the state, the instruments of the government and of the state, and use this to shut down our opposition and to basically to have an established religion imposed on people. Because they don't have a rational argument for their view either.
Well, I just want to jump in. What you're invoking here is the subjectivist background that is going back to Kant and as modified by Marx, Hegel and Marx and others. But one aspect that came from Marx especially and was trumpeted by Foucault was that not only that it's subjective, but that views are imposed by force. And therefore, the entire idea of individual rights, of the distinction between, you know, someone, government force or criminal force versus influence, intellectually, culturally, whatever, is all treated as the exercise of coercion, of force. And that's part of the equation, too. And so my question to you is, do you think that affects the debate going on here that people like Rufo and Shapiro are, you know, fighting back against an issue of imposing things by force on campus or more broadly?
I think they absolutely depend on this idea that social pressure is equivalent to coercion. And actually, you know, that comes from Marx and it comes from Foucault, but it also even goes back to John Stuart Mill, who's one of the great classical liberals. Because I recently read Mill like all the way through for the first time. Not just I'd read parts and pieces of it, but when you read parts and pieces, you don't quite get the full impact that he actually comes in, and his main concern is this idea of social coercion, is this idea that the tyranny of public opinion that would impose ideas on people. And he has a good point about that, by the way. You know, there's a lot of valid things he says about how, you know, and this is, I hosted a debate on this among some, Kathy Young and Robert Garmon and a couple other people, about this idea of the culture of free speech. And I think there's definitely something to this, that in addition to the coercive aspect, you know, the libertarian argument of, okay, you know, free speech is really means the government can't force you to do something. But in addition to the coercive aspect, there is something to this idea that you also need a culture of free speech. You need a culture in which a diversity of the ideas is tolerated. I mentioned Jonathan Rauch earlier. He has a really good book out recently. Has some philosophical errors, but some really interesting observations about how you know, the whole system that we have for gaining knowledge as a society, the book is called The Constitution of Knowledge, says there's this whole system we have for gaining knowledge as a society, and like the Constitution, he goes back to Madison, Madison's arguments with the Constitution, where Madison says you need a diversity of different factions with different interests in order to make our political system work. And Rauch makes the argument you also need a diversity of different viewpoints and different arguments and different perspectives in order to make our system for gaining knowledge work, because you have to have all the, you know, everybody bringing all the different viewpoints and facing them off against each other and being willing to consider each and every argument that comes up. And if you close yourself off and say, we're not going to consider certain arguments, then you are, you know, starving the system of gaining knowledge. You're starving it of material and you're blinding it to certain things. So he makes some very good arguments, and those are very John Stuart Mill type of arguments. So there's a lot of good to that, but Mill also did sort of popularize this idea that the force of social opinion could be coercive. And so it comes, you know, and that's what the both sides used. You know, the conservatives say, well, look, wokeness is the force of social opinion. It's coercive. If Facebook won't, you know, shuts down my anti-vax page, they're coercing me. And then they use that as an excuse to engage in coercion of their own in return.
Yeah.
Or the woke people say, well, look, you know, this is the Foucault argument. Well, look, you're already forcing, you know, the fact that people regard heterosexuality as normal. This is the heteronormativity. The fact that people regard heterosexuality as the norm because it's, you know, 97% of the population is heterosexual. The fact that that's considered a social norm is inherently oppressive and coercive to me, so I can engage in coercion against you back in order to, in self-defense. And that's sort of this Pandora's box that was opened by this idea of social coercion.
Yeah. One of the hardest things, I'll just say, because I wrote about Mill in my old book, Truth and Toleration, that it's a delicate balance to invite a range of ideas so that we can all benefit from differences of opinion and challenge our cognitive biases. But at the same time, you know, it maintaining a standard of that there is a world out there, there is a truth, and we're engaged. The whole point of allowing and encouraging diversity of opinion is to find the truth. It's not an end in itself, but it has a goal. Anyway, it's a delicate balance, and so.
Yeah, and I think it's a difficult thing because it involves judgment. It involves judgment calls of like, well, okay, the Holocaust deniers we're not going to allow in. But, you know, what about these? What about the global warming, the global warming skeptics? Do we allow them in? And of course, I obviously, being a global warming skeptic, I'd say, yes, allow us in. But, you know, people have to make those. There are all these judgment calls that you don't have necessarily a hard and fast rule you can lay down that would say what, you know, you who you let in and who you don't. You actually have to use reason. You have to be the sort of maddening thing about the law is the reasonable man standard, right? That there's all these legal principles that require you to say, well, what would a reasonable man do in this case? And it's not some sort of mechanical rule that you can use. You have to use your judgment and use your reason to project what a reasonable person would do. So it's something that doesn't make for good legislation or politics. It makes for, you know, it's something that really does have to be handled in the realm of debate and discussion, because it involves you having to make these judgment calls of using your own individual reason.
Thank you, Rob. And we have Professor Stephen Hicks, who certainly has had experience over the years with these trends with students not just disagreeing or feeling hurt or offended or angry, but in some cases also just refusing to listen. Although if I know Professor Hicks, he's found a way. But Stephen, what's your perspective on the discussion?
Yeah, hi, Rob. I want to say I've enjoyed listening in on this. I have a question that's maybe more psychological than philosophical. So you point out that on the left, there's problems of subjectivism and problems of tribalism. And then on the right, the conservatives, we find also tribalism and subjectivism. And we can trace various arguments back to Kant, Hegel, Marx, as you did. And there's a subjectivist theme that runs through. And then people make commitments to different tribes, depending on what subjective commitments they want to. But I guess my question is, do you have a sense for whether the tribalism comes first in the thinking, or if it's the subjectivism that comes first? Because I can imagine, and the way it seems to me when I talk with many of these people, that the first thing is not so much epistemology, but rather they're making a value commitment to a group, a tribe, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of way of life and so on. And that comes first. And then what happens is when they get pressed for arguments and facts and so on, then they fall back on the subjectivist epistemology. But it's being used rather rhetorically. It's not like they really believe it necessarily. And then, of course, it can go the other way. People will make commitments to a subjectivist epistemology. Nobody knows anything, so I might as well just believe whatever, and then make a subjective commitment to some sort of tribe or other. So I wrestle with whether it's the tribalism that comes first and the subjectivism is a cover for it, or whether the subjectivism comes first and the tribalism is just a downstream commitment. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's a great avenue to explore, and I do have definite thoughts on that. It is kind of a chicken and the egg question, right? But I think that, although there isn't actually an answer to the chicken and the egg question, which is the egg came first. But anyway, we'll get to that some other time. But in this case, I'd say the tribalism comes first, because both historically, right, people lived in tribal living was the default mode of human existence from the very beginning. And I would say the broader context of that is rationality is an achievement, you know, create achievement that we rose to over 50,000 years from being in tribes and just following whatever the tribal leader does, to being able to use your individual judgment and arrive at new truths about the world. So rationality is an achievement, and the default mode, if you don't do that achievement, is always tribalism on the broadest historical perspective. But I also think that has to do in the development of every individual. There is typically, you know, you start to grapple with these ideas before you become fully consciously aware of and able to handle all the complex philosophical arguments. And I think that's mm-hmm. very true of, you know, for those, I mean, I was somebody who wanted to be an academic philosopher when I was 17. So I was actually paying attention to the philosophical arguments when I was a teenager. Most people are not. So before they come to the philosophical arguments, I think they typically do pick red team or blue team. And you know, you do it based on, and oftentimes based on, you know, valid reasons. You know, there's something you validly like about one side and don't like about the other side. So, you know, if you were raised in a very intolerant Christian environment in one of the red states, out in a very religious area of the country, and you rebel against the religious dogmatism, it might seem to you that, well, these free thinking people, secular people on the left are the answer, and the progressives are the answer. And if you actually encounter the supposedly free thinking not remotely progressive and free thinking, you might rebel against that and say, oh, well, you know, somebody has to assert the truth and what's right and defend all the great achievements of Western civilization and traditional culture. And so therefore I'm going to sign up with the right. And I think that's sort of how people tend to arrive at these loyalties early on, before they are rising to the level of being aware of the philosophical issues. And then the choice has to be, do you stick with that general tribal affinity? Or when you start to become aware of the bigger issues, do you actually investigate them and think them through and become an independent thinker? Or do you continue to be invested in this purely as a tribal identity? In which case, if you do that, then you're going to gravitate to the sort of subjectivist arguments from the left or faith-based arguments from the right as a way of, I think you're right, I would say it's not just cover for your tribalism. I think it's an expression of the tribal outlook. You know, it's that in the tribal outlook, what you believe is right because you people like you believe it. And there's that, it's sort of like, it's symbiotic with the tribal outlook. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, everyone, we're actually over our hour. And so I wanted to apologize in particular to Omar. I see you have your hand raised, but I do want to end this as close to on the hour as possible. We're about 6 minutes over. So I'm going to mention some of the other opportunities that we are going to have to chat on Clubhouse. We're going to be here, of course, next Tuesday with Rob Trusinski, and then also we will have our regular Thursday session as well. So this coming Thursday, it is Professor Jason Hill at the helm. We're going to be doing something a little different, kind of an AMA, an Ask Me Anything. So bring your questions. but we're also going to draw on a bit of the questions that pour in every week on Instagram. If you're not following the Atlas Society on Instagram, twice a week we do Instagram takeovers. And I do them. You guys send in questions. I do quick 1-minute video answers, and also Professor Richard Salzman does them. Jason Hill does them, and some of you do them as well. So we're going to try to look at some of those questions because they're all over the map. David hasn't done the takeovers, although he scripts a lot of the takeovers because he's my go-to for getting quick answers to some of these media questions. So that will be fun. If you would like to join us on Wednesday, I'm going to have kind of a different webinar. So we have our live webinars. You can find them on the events section of the Atlas Society site. They are live streaming on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube. And this week, again, kind of different. I'm going to be interviewing Blake J. Harris. He is the author of The History of the Future, which is about Oculus and Facebook's acquisition of Oculus, and of course about Palmer Luckey, who is going to be speaking at our gala in Malibu on November 4th. So hope you will join us for that. And if you guys want to get in touch with us, check out the Atlas Society's website, atlassociety.org. Use the contact form there if you have questions or suggestions on what we might take on as a future topic. So thank you so much, Rob, and thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks. Bye.